You can take the fight. I think you must take the fight because the market is big. It's not a winner-take-all. And there is a space for a brand which has a different voice, which is perhaps talking to 10 to 15 million families in India, which is talking a language which is different, which is not built on the core, what I call Khisa Pitta platforms of, you know, Saw Nimbu and Panch Guna Safedi and 99.9% Germ Kill. This is a different language. These are people who care about different things and they're reinterpreting cleaning. The only uniqueness, I think, in any D2C startup is the founder. I think the product is replicable. The distribution channels are highly similar. You're unlikely to have any strategic advantage in one versus another player. There's three shows which have, in recent times, you know, which have hit the ball out of the park in terms of understanding the consumers and genuinely doing. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say nation building. One of them was...
My next guest on the 1% Project is a charismatic CEO of Koparo, Simran Khara. This is a conversation about her journey from McKinsey to entrepreneurship. Simran has an MBA from the Indian School of Business and is an alumnus of the London School of Economics and Shriram College of Commerce. With over 16 years of experience, she has advised, built and monetized in her roles at McKinsey, Star TV, Juggernaut Books, and now at Koparo, a D2C toxin-free home care brand. In this conversation, Simran talks about the importance of discipline, adaptability, and social skills that she imbibed growing up in a Fauji family, the liberating environment Mumbai offers to women, her role at Star TV and what she gathered from a mentor, Uday Shankar, becoming the CEO of Juggernaut Books, building Koparo, the impact of being featured on Shark Tank India, and much more. This conversation inspired me to kick off a series on first-time founders, where I will invite young and experienced entrepreneurs who will share their journey of building a business with no prior entrepreneurial experience. If you have any guest recommendations, drop me a line at pritish@1%.live. The email is in the show notes. Subscribe to the show wherever you're listening to it and stay connected with the 1% Project's Think newsletter at 1%.live for curated content that will elevate your professional and personal development. We kick this discussion off by asking Simran about her upbringing in an army family and which Indian city has had the most impact on her life.
I'll answer the second part first, which has been the most memorable city for me. And that has been Mumbai because I found love. My husband belongs to Bombay. My daughter was born there. And I spent the sort of very exciting post-MBA, first job, second job years there. So two of the companies that I worked in, both McKinsey as well as Star, Hotstar, were based there. But in many ways, there was a lot of firsts in Mumbai. It's genuinely one of the best places in India for professional women, for working women, for young women who you don't want to be thinking about what time is it, am I leaving office late, hanging out with colleagues post-work. It's safe and it works. And I think I recommend a stint in Mumbai to everybody who works, but most definitely, I would say young women, because it can be very liberating to not carry that burden, which you do oftentimes when you're working in some of the other cities. And now it's true, you know, about learnings, being a Fauji brat. I think one thing you learn is, you know, the cliched stuff, I think you know, ki, you know, obviously you wake up on time and the breakfast is removed from the table if you're late. And there's almost a pleasure derived in living a disciplined life. So I think all of that is one thing, but I think it's known and it's written about. But I think you learn how to pack because you pack your house every three years. You learn what is important, what's the stuff that you have to carry with yourself. You learn to look after your things a lot more. And I think you definitely learn certain social skills, which is dealing with, you know, you'll often meet, obviously, when you travel and you're not necessarily in the army cantonment, any expat kids, etc. also. You know, you expand your horizon. You will definitely be meeting people from different backgrounds, but you will also meet people who are younger than you. There are people who are older than you. There'd be a new lieutenant who's just joined. Everybody's got different life stages. Somebody, you know, one uncle and auntie will have old parents. Somebody else has just had a baby. So you learn a lot because it's very tight-knit also, because it's not just about the sort of peripatetic sort of way or the wandering way, but it's also your cantonment life, which tends to be tighter. So yeah, very proud Fauji brat, and I can pack like a ninja. I'm ruthlessly organized about my stuff and I find it easy to talk to people, and I hope a more pleasant and affable human being. And I think a lot of that I credit to my early years that I've spent with my parents.
All of that is true, and all of that reflects going from being organized, ISB, potentially top of class, and into McKinsey. You have to have a very organized thinking to get there. Given that kind of an environment, do you think that you are an alpha, an aggressive individual?
I think there is a certain competitive streak that middle class kids born in the 80s have, and I have it, because we had to fight. You want to end up at the top of the heap because the opportunities are limited. I think the economy today, the jobs today, is far richer, far more diverse in greater numbers than when we were actually starting out. So there was an inbuilt sort of spirit to survive and thrive, which has served me well. I define my own alpha. I mean, I am an alpha to the extent that I want to excel, I want to do well. But I won't necessarily say that my working style or my boardroom style is highly aggressive. I think it's very sharp, and therefore it requires a certain maturity on the other end, because I'd call out, let's say, bullshit. It's not necessarily aggressive. Yes, competitive, but I wouldn't say aggressive.
In our previous conversation, you mentioned empathy is your biggest strength. Being competitive, being somebody who is an alpha, empathy is not something which is usually associated to such individuals. Do you agree to that or you disagree to that? How do you see that, empathy and being competitive?
I think empathy and self-awareness are just two parts of the same coin. And I think if you are a competitive human being, because that's how you know how to play the game, or you want to be top of the heap every single time and that's defining you, you can still be highly self-aware and empathetic. So I don't think, you know, if you are a competitive person, you're not empathetic. And I don't think the most empathetic people in the world are the most, let's say, the most generous. So it's, I think, just about having a high degree of self-awareness, also understanding what are other people's motivations. I could pick for hours because it's working for Koparo. And somebody else may have very different motivations. And if you need to work together in any fashion, you do have to have an understanding. I think it's self-awareness, which is very important, and an awareness, an emotional awareness, saying that everybody is at a different life stage. Folks are solving for different things. Starting points of human beings are different. Their motivations will be different. And therefore, your dealings have to be different.
From McKinsey, you joined Star TV as a chief of staff. And back then, at least, it was a very male-dominated industry. That was an interesting switch, not only in terms of industry, but also in terms of the role that you took. Because chief of staff is a role which gives you a lot of overview across the company, but at the same time, it's you're doing special projects. So why did you choose that? What kind of overview did this role give you? And then you moved on to products, revenue within Star TV and Hotstar. So what was that journey?
It's not that unique for a consultant to move over to a more operating role in an industry. Particularly, you may be serving that client. And that's exactly what happened with me, where Star was actually a client for us at McKinsey. And I used to be on that study and project. And I had the opportunity to understand what their plans were, but also get to know the CEO. And that built a great degree of comfort to me, saying that if I'm joining, because you join a place, but you also join a team, you join a person. That's what happened. I moved over to Star. Star was a client. I was very blown, I would say, by the vision. It was a very audacious, very ambitious goal. This was very heady days of broadcasting, where this is 2010. The revenue pools were exploding in newer sort of vernacular pools were coming to play. Cable and subscription penetrations were increasing. Our pools were going up. There was a lot of green ticks and a lot of sort of tailwinds in the industry. And I knew that if this industry is going to grow, and here's a player who's really betting big, and here's a CEO who's, I genuinely believe, visionary, Uday Shankar, then this is the right team to join, you know, because I'm going to get to learn. And once you get to learn, you will grow. You will flourish as a professional. You can't control every year what your designation is going to be and what your increment is going to be, because there is so much that goes into that. But at least I knew directionally this was going to be the right place for me. Ultimately, a leap of faith that you take, because consulting is obviously a much more structured life and it's a much more set path. and this was going to be different. Learned a lot. So, I mean, began as chief of staff because that is kind of what opened up for consultants back in the day. You were expected to be smart. You were expected to be a bit cocky. And you were expected to be, operations mein kuch nahi aayega isko. So let this person learn for 2-3 years. Either she will do so well that she can go ahead and do something big in the company from an operations standpoint, or she will hate it so much because it is so not what she wanted it to be that she'd leave. And I think that's the general thing which happens when you kind of move from a very structured role, a very established sort of way of working, to a place which is much more chaotic, which is much more dynamic. And then obviously, you know, the fact that I stayed on for the years that I did at Star, I enjoyed myself a great deal.
What did you learn from Uday?
Uday really taught me the importance of big hits and big ideas. He's somebody who solves for big outcomes. He plays that game better than anybody that I know in the corporate space today. And I work directly with him. So even in Koparo, he's an angel investor. And when I went to him, whenever I try and give him an update, his big question to me is, that's great, that's what you'll do in 3 years. Now, how can you do that in 3 months? Not a single investor asked me that question. Uday does, and he means it. And therefore, I think he pushes you in a very non-linear path, very non-linear thinker. So I learned a lot about thinking, but about courage.
You took the operational route. Among all the segments in a business, operations, marketing, finance, sales, which of those trainings are most critical to become an effective CEO?
Tough one to answer, but I would say that I'd lean more towards sales because I think that the answer is perhaps somewhere between marketing and sales. And obviously, you do need some amount of understanding of demand generation, and therefore marketing is critical. But the rubber hits the road when there is fulfillment, and that needs sales. The ability to close deals, to identify and sniff opportunities, to not leave anything on the table, and to do all of this while you're making friends along the way, that's something that you learn in sales. That's something that I learned in sales. It's the most valuable thing because I'm not scared of targets. And I also can't operate without targets. The fact that I can do both makes it special. Because it gives you the ability to click in and click out both. Because you know the big picture number you're chasing and why. But you also know how you did in February and whether March or April can pan out for you. And that you just intuitively know once you've done sales for a few years.
Brilliant. And obviously, everybody has their own path. But data shows that 70% of global CEOs have an operational background, which, by the way, amazed me as well, because I exactly thought like you that it has to be sales. It has to be something which is more customer facing. From Hotstar, you took a maternity break and then joined Juggernaut as CEO. How did that transition happen? And how did you, even after break, got the opportunity to become the CEO of the company?
So a lot of happenstance. I had moved from Bombay to Delhi when Meera was born 8 years ago. And at that time, I took a year off and then I began evaluating opportunities. Obviously, having the experience that I did have in media, I did look for certain roles. And this role I found to be the most interesting that came my way because it was an opportunity to obviously work in media to solve what's an interesting problem, which is to get digitally native Indians to read more, because we read woefully very less. And to see if the same digital dividend, which when applied to video, audio, just led to a big explosion of consumption, if the same thing would happen here. So it was a bold question to ask. It was in media. And then obviously the fact that I had revenue experience in media meant that I could solve the monetization piece of it as well alongside. I happened to meet the founder, Chihi, over lunch. And something about that conversation made me feel that this could be home for some time. It's very important for me to get that comfort because when you are hiring someone at a CEO level and you already have a founder, there has to be a clear demarcation of roles, but there has to be a big pact of understanding. And I got that comfort. And of course, you know, while this is the textbook answer of why Juggernaut, but I think what this selfishly also helped me do was to understand the digital startup ecosystem. Because prior to this, between McKinsey and Star and Hotstar, I had very little exposure to the startup world. And this world is a different world. It has different energies. It bounces in different ways. And I felt that it was a great time to get that understanding, because it was still very early days of the ecosystem. They still are, but it was an opportunity to be the CEO of a startup. And that in itself gives you so much learning.
Well, that's a brilliant segue into going from big multinationals, very structured environment, to a startup which is in itself niche. Juggernaut is competing against the penguins of India and globally. So how did it position itself? Because it really has some amazing authors who have published with Juggernaut. Ankur Varaku, the CEO Factory, all of these authors are pretty significant when they published the book or when they did the first publication. So how did Juggernaut pitch to them, or what attracted them to Juggernaut and not signing the same book deal with Penguin?
I think the book industry, the fact that some of these larger players have big book lists, and therefore you're one in maybe 200 or 300 books that will get published, versus saying you will be one in 30 that will get published or one in 40 that will get published by Juggernaut, and therefore you will get a lot of attention. It's one factor that helps, because that individually, that title or author means more to us. That was something that would resonate with people. But ultimately, people want results. So I think on distribution and with Juggernaut, we did a deal with HarperCollins, where the distribution from a physical standpoint was the Harper distribution. And that is equivalent to anybody else's distribution. And that also gives people comfort. And then finally, results speak for themselves. Juggernaut has a great track history. So their hit rates are definitely way higher than Penguin or with Harper. And hit rates are consistently higher. And they've been able to churn out bestsellers in popular fiction, but definitely in nonfiction. So a big strength is there in nonfiction. And therefore, I think people do look at results as well. You can have a pitch and you can say, I will give you attention, but they need that comfort that my book will sell and will sell the right amount of copies, even though I went with you. And I think Juggernaut does a great job of marketing. I think they market their titles uniquely. Again, I think a function of the fact that you have lesser titles to market in a year, and therefore you can give it more attention.
One thing that I've observed, Juggernaut books are very affordably priced. Is that a function of penetration into the market?
Yes, I think the books will always be affordable. I think Juggernaut is what I would call a mainstream nonfiction publisher. I think one of the insights that Cheeky and I had very early on was that people want some gratification from the book. You want to have learned something from this book. You pick up the CEO Factory, it feels like a mini MBA. Pick up Ankur Variku's first book that he did with us, it feels like the self-help book that a slightly lost millennial wants today. Say, okay, fine, I'm dealing with this problem. Let me read this chapter. Okay, now it makes sense. You have to be helping people with something that they are grappling with. And you have to talk young. And therefore, you have to be affordable, because books cannot be the domain of just the elite. So Juggernaut is not always about hardbacks and glossy covers. It is much more hard-hitting, much more affordable. Even from a digital business standpoint, they were the first to pioneer 10 rupee episodic content, 30 rupee books. You could read certain novellas for 50 rupees and so on. So the idea is that, look, if stuff is accessible because it's in your phone, if it's affordable, and if it's a genre that you enjoy, then we have given you everything. Now we expect you to read. And I think that's what we try to solve at Juggernaut.
I always look forward to new books that Juggernaut publishes. Coming back also, because you mentioned that it publishes limited numbers every year in terms of titles, how does it choose its authors or its subjects?
So Juggernaut has these famous edit meetings where the editorial team will sit together and will talk about things, because ultimately the books are essentially text. It's a reflection of what is going on today. What are the topics of interest today? And can you look out and see 6 months down the line, 10 months down the line, what would be interesting? So naturally, now Pratish, you will see a slew of election books launching, you know, not just from Jago, but from many people. So there are different topics and different themes. And this is very much an edit meeting which happens. And it's fairly meritocratic, you know. So the junior most editor can have a great idea. And then that is something that they can develop and chase. And then, of course, there's the authors. Certain things take more time to get ready. And certain things happen faster. And then you're gonna, the demand and the supply have to meet for you to have a schedule. But I think one of the things we are very clear about is that if it's, for example, a CEO who's writing a book, the CEO should have something interesting to share. They should have maybe some digital media followership because that's where books are getting marketed today. So the decisions have to be based in the fact that the topic is very interesting, the marketing angle can be very interesting because ultimately the goal is to get more and more copies out there, to get more and more people to read. If a genre is interesting because it may not be a mainstream book idea, but if it's a genre which is doing well on television, then why shouldn't that genre also get replicated from a book standpoint? You know, maybe it's supernatural stories. It's a big theme. It used to be a big theme almost a decade ago. We should have some books about it. We take some of those choices and try and flesh them out because once you have an idea and a theme, you still need the author, you still need the book to make sense and, you know, all the timing to fall into place.
So from Juggernaut, you went on to launch Koparo, a home cleaning personal hygiene product. Now, this is interesting because a home cleaning personal hygiene product is highly commoditized with well-established brands. Why did you think that Koparo stood a chance?
In some ways, I think that's a big advantage that I have, that there are well-established brands here because clearly there's a market here. There's a big opportunity here. They have become well-established by selling a proposition. So clearly, hygiene and cleaning is big and it's here to stay. I think what attracted me to this industry is the fact that it's large and there's huge repeatability. If you like my product, you will wash your dishes thrice a day with it. If you like my detergent, you will probably do 2 loads a day with my detergent. If you like my detergent, by the way, you may buy my floor cleaner. So I loved the fact that there was a lot of repeatability and cross-sell, which was intuitively built into this. And whereas the proposition was concerned, I felt that there's been very little innovation, whether in form or in communication or product and formulation by the large players in this industry. The consumer has moved on rapidly, whether we look at food choices, you look at what kind of ghee people are buying today, how and what are the buying criteria when they're buying pulses and dals. Apparel, we're modernized in every possible way, but the supply is the same in cleaning, and hence nobody else has come up with a different proposition. What we're also seeing now is that steadily there is a growing voice of consumer, which is demanding a different home cleaning proposition. We were recently on Shark Tank, and we were top 5 in all the cleaning categories for 10 days straight because we were able to get our message across. And here we were absolutely dislodging the big guys. So we were giving competition to multiple SKUs of Vim. We outsold multiple SKUs of Surf Excel. We did better than Lysol on many days in my floor cleaner. So I think you can take the fight. I think you must take the fight because the market is big. It's not a winner-take-all. And there is a space for a brand which has a different voice, which is perhaps talking to 10 to 15 million families in India, which is talking a language which is different, which is not built on the core, what I call Kisa Pitta platforms of, you know, Saw Nimbu and Panch Guna Safedi and 99.9% Germ Kill. This is a different language. These are people who care about different things and they're reinterpreting cleaning. Because frankly, homes mean differently to them than they did a couple of decades ago. I absolutely felt that there's a space. I think when you're from investing, so you'd know this. I think there are so many notions that people have that this category, how you're going to outspend them on this and that. But honestly, there's never been a better time to take the fight to any MNC major today because the consumer is willing to experiment. If the consumer is willing to experiment, you just need to figure out your price point and your availability and have a sharp communication. Frankly, anybody who's terrifying you any more than that basically doesn't know it. That's it, yeah.
Or they don't want you to launch.
Probably, yeah.
Brilliant. You talked about Shark Tank. Let's first touch upon that. You've written an amazing post on LinkedIn about your Shark Tank journey. But before that, what made you think or who pushed you to actually even apply to Shark Tank. How did that journey begin?
Yeah, that's a simple answer. My team pushed me because they were consumers. So they watched season two very avidly and they were like, Simran, aapse kuch baat karni hai. And I was like, sure, because we have these weekly catch-ups. And they were like, we have to apply to Shark Tank. And I was like, why? Then they were like, okay, we're going to show you data because you're only going to listen when we show you data. And I said, yes, absolutely. And then what we saw was the trajectory, acceleration that happens with 15, 17 minutes of uninterrupted storytelling on television. It's dramatic. So it felt worthwhile to say that if we really have a product that can appeal to people across the board, we must tell our story. And if we want to really take the fight to the large CPG players who are advertising all the time, right, on TV, then we should be present on TV and tell our story and see if the consumer bites. So I honestly felt that it was a great place to test some of these hypotheses. And then, of course, once I genuinely believe if you're doing something, then you should do a good job of it. So we went through the process. It's a lengthy process between the applications, some kind of text pitches, then video pitches, then audition round and so on. But we just put our best foot forward every time we were asked to show up. And really, it's been magical since. So some great magic happened on the 6th of Feb that night. We've been selling 14 dishwash every minute. The purchase orders are not stopping, but we're having different kinds of problems now. But demand generation is not one of them. So I'm happy to say that.
Detergent, it's a competitive market. D2C, again, a competitive industry. What are your observations? Is the only way to win is about outreach? How do you become unique? How do you step out and level up your game or go beyond the best D2C brands that are there in the market?
Very few D2C startups can have product differentiation, which is not replicable. Now, we can all start off with unique products, but replication is very easy. There's a ton of reverse engineering that can happen. A lot of factories today, which are contract manufacturing facilities, will offer you catalogs. If you want to launch a home care brand, you just tick 9 products on the catalog. Somebody else will come in, they'll slap some labels on, done, boom, 6 weeks, you're ready. So that exists too. So the only true way to be unique over a long period of time is that there is only one Simran Khara. And you have to bring your true authentic self to your range. That is your only genuine unique point. Now, is that enough? I don't know. Therefore, you have to do other things. You have to amplify with marketing. You've got to obviously be available. And you have to keep going back to your consumers and seeing if your proposition is working for them. Because the same proposition that worked for them 5 years ago may not work for them. So there is no easy answer. But the only uniqueness, I think, in any D2C startup is the founder. I think the product is replicable. The distribution channels are highly similar. You're unlikely to have any strategic advantage in one versus another player. But what's your story? What's your sharpest communication? That's how great brands get built. So that's what we want to do at Kuparo.
You were a CEO, now you're a founder CEO. And you have dealt with sales functions within big organizations. My understanding is, in terms of salary compensation negotiation, people who have already drank the Kool-Aid about the job, about the role, about the founder, don't land up making the best comp compared to somebody who looks at it from a professional standpoint, saying that this is a role, I need to be competitive at it, I need to excel, and I need to perform the best.
I think basically what you're saying is, if there's a romance with the CEO almost, right, where you feel that, wow, like, I got to work for Simran or I got to work for Pritish, you're willing to leave X rupees on the table. I think absolutely, we're human beings. We're constantly making trade-offs in our heads, very complicated trade-offs in our head, so quickly and rationalizing them so beautifully that you would not even realize what you've done. So I think, definitely, I think it works. At the same time, my advice to young people is that you should only work in a startup if you believe in the founder. You know, and of course, some startups are very large and you may not have a lot of exposure, but you do. Like, you do know through third party, what is this person about? Through interviews, through podcasts like this, what is this person about? So I think there must be an overall buy-in. But beyond that, it's very important to solve for yourself. I'm anyway have a slightly controversial take on it. I think money is important, but I think in the early stages of your career, if you aren't maximizing learning and trajectory, then in the long run, you will have potentially less money. So even if you are only solving for money, I think it's very important to solve for role and fitment and trajectory. And by trajectory, the trajectory of the company. Because if you're on a rocket ship, you will get to the moon. If you're on a ship, you know, you'll get to the port. So it's your choice.
You have been in specialist roles and you talked about youngsters. These days, youngsters really talk about being a generalist and they overemphasize or glorify it. And I feel that a CEO's role is the biggest generalist role in the world. So how do you look at it?
I think there's a combination of two factors here, right? What is it that you enjoy doing? And then the opportunities that are coming your way. The roles that you take and you're good at will be at the intersection of this. You could want to be a generalist forever, but there is going to be a time that your organization will ask you to step up and lead a specialist function, at which point you will have to make that choice. So I think the opportunities matter. But I think my advice here is that I often also see this deep desire to be a generalist. And sometimes you're really good at something. If you're very good in sales, you should be in sales because you will rise there like nobody's business. You may want to dabble in marketing to also understand demand generation, but maybe that will also help you be better at sales. And then you should go back to sales. So I think it's really about the person. What do you enjoy doing? If you absolutely enjoy and you're good at a function, there's really, I don't think it's a badge of honor to say that I'm a generalist. I think that's incorrect because that's a disservice to your own potential. You know these people, you probably know these people I'm talking about, where they're so good at something, but we get caught up in wanting to say that, but I haven't done a stint in finance. Oh, but I haven't done operations. So you'll go to finance in some wacko place, which has added no value to your resume. And then after that, you're like, ye bilkul nahi karna. I think that don't force fit it. Of course, if you're good at something, you enjoy it. And if maybe you're actually good at two or three things, in which case, find your spike. But I think eventually there will be a spike. Even as a CEO, while you're a generalist, you will always have a spike. You will be good at one thing more than anything else. And then that's how you'll hire your top team, where you will complement your skills. I don't think somebody can be absolutely the same level of excellent at everything. It's not possible.
In one of your interviews, you had mentioned that struggle is an evolving concept. You double click on that. What does that mean?
We're all evolving and we should be, right? So the stuff that I struggled with in business school was very different. I think my struggles were about what's the job that I'm going to get? What are my grades like? When you join your first job, it's a different level of struggle. Before Shark Tank, we were struggling with demand generation. Today, we are struggling with stocks. But that's, of course, very operational. But I think depending on your life stage and the stage of your company and what your sort of goals are, you will always have newer challenges and newer struggles. Today, one of the deep struggles that I have is that I want to be a great role model to my daughter. While I want to build Kuparo into a rocket ship and take it to the moon, but I want to be present for Meera, because that would make my journey very worthwhile. So I think it's always evolving. My mother today shares with me because my granny lives with her. So her struggles are about making sure my grandmother has the best quality of life as she becomes 90 years old and older. Our struggles will keep evolving. I think that's generally the journey of being a human being. The journey keep evolving.
What is a counterintuitive insight of entrepreneurship?
I think one of the things you think is that if you're the founder and you're the CEO, you're the boss. You control everything. You learn very quickly, you control nothing. All outages are beyond your control. Competition behavior is out of your control. The economy and the context can change very rapidly. The dynamics in your team can change. Your hiring plans can go awry. I think two things have taught me this, and I think they're probably similar. I think one is being a parent, and one is being a founder, where I feel like, again, it's like being a parent. You don't control anything. You just broadly provide some direction and you make it a safe space for people to work and learn and you make it a safe space for your child as a mother, but you don't control the destiny.
Do you aspire to be a shark one day?
I love this question, Pritish. So if Sony's watching, sure. I think to give credit where it's due, the show Every year it gets better because in general, you know, you do some the same thing over and over again, you get better at it. But I think what is the sort of what I have realized is that it's genuinely transformational. And it is actually sparking future entrepreneurs. And we're a country where we are a country of entrepreneurs. We've always been a country of entrepreneurs. I was thinking of fancy word bolne entrepreneurs, but we are. We absolutely are a country of small business owners. So I feel ki the show is doing great service because they're also giving it a polish and a shine, right? And they're making it aspirational. They're not making it saying that, oh, IIT mein nahi hua Sharma ji ka, toh matlab wo yahan pe apne ladki ko bitha diya hai. They're making it aspirational. And that, in my opinion, can unlock serious value. Having worked in TV, I'd say that there's three shows which have, in recent times, you know, which have hit the ball out of the park in terms of understanding the consumers and genuinely doing. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say nation building. And I think one of them was KBC because of the reasons that you know, so I will not go into them. The other was Satyamev Jayate because it spoke the truth so beautifully, so brilliantly, and made you uncomfortable. And then Shark Tank, because I actually think that this is a job creation engine that India needs. And somebody's got to make entrepreneurship aspirational. And they're doing it. They're doing it. And you can see it. It's a movement. You're in Hong Kong, but the pulse here, the viewership, it's staggering.
Brilliant. And before we close, what does success mean to you?
My mom, my daughter, my family being proud of where I've come. That's success. It's as simple as that. When my granny called me, and she said, Simran, mujhe ab samajh aaya hai why you left, you know, a big job to make your startup. Because I saw you on Shark Tank. It was like, oh my God, look, that kind of moment. Yeah, it's really recognition from your loved ones and praise from them. I think it's as simple as that. We often get complicated and caught up in numbers, but there's no number on it. It's just that phone call.
Brilliant. Simran, it was amazing to have you on the show. Thanks.
Thank you, Pritesh. I loved speaking to you. And I do come to Hong Kong sometimes because I have some friends there. I will certainly give you a call.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone who will find it valuable. For any recommendations and feedback, you can drop me a line at pritesh@1%.live. Until next time. You can find the show notes for this episode and every other episode on 1%.live. If you enjoyed this conversation, share it on social media and leave a review. See you next time.